Welcome, welcome to the Cause and Effect podcast. And we're doing a little refresh with my good, I'm going to throw in one of my best friends, Lou Raja. We did a podcast interview about 15 months ago with Lou, and you'll hear all about that in about 10 minutes. But what I wanted to do is just kind of start with a little gratitude. Lou started something at the beginning of last year, and it was something really simple that has turned into an incredible friendship. And so I am hugely grateful, and maybe all of you who are listening can think of one simple thing to do with a good friend you have, or maybe a newer friend you have. And what Lou did was he started, and I think he's on close to 300 consecutive days in a row, where he started with texting me. If you don't know, Lou is a beautiful black man that grew up in the Congo, moved to Ashland, Oregon when he was 17, and I am a average white guy. And so what Lou did is, through the beginning of our friendship, started to text me every day a different clip, a video clip from YouTube, typically, whether it was spoken word or a historical lesson or something from the black experience, to get me to have a more deepened perspective of what it's like to be black in this world. And that daily, every day, including weekends, including his vacations, all of that turned into daily conversation and turned into just an awesome friendship. So, Lou, like, what gave you that idea? Have you ever done that before? You know, I know everyone we interview on this podcast is very intentional about things. So clearly that was an intention. I just, you know, how did you think of that?
Well, first of all, it's great to be back and to connect with you and your audience. I just needed an anchor, a daily intentional anchor to not only hold myself accountable to, but it's such an easy way. It's like brushing your teeth, to actually couch something very important, like sharing perspective. As individuals, you know, to co-experience, to walk a mile in someone else's shoes is the superpower of empathy, right? And so for us to know each other as friends, as peers, as influencers, whatever the terms might be, we just gotta go deep. And we're all busy. But a 2-3 minute intentional text message on a daily basis that gives you just different side of the black experience, I think it's basically me pulling back the curtains, sharing where I'm coming from, as you have, and I just don't see a better way to do it. Now, the consistency of it helps too, right? I've done it in my personal life after climbing Mount Kilimanjaro 2.5 years ago, where I focused on 4 areas of my life: money, time, relationships, and purpose. And when I did those 4 things, I became very routine heavy, because creating some kind of a system, they say that systems always beat intentions, right? So if you can automate something, you have a better chance at success. And so connecting with you was an awesome experience. And I thought, okay, let's make it even richer than it is. And now I'm actually hooked. So I'm just going to continue on.
Yeah, you were going to end at the end of last year. Yeah. And now 2020,
it just keeps going.
Yeah.
Because in fact, the 2 days or whatever that I didn't do it, and I thought, wow, something's off. And so, yeah, now I don't know, man. It's like it's an ongoing thing, and I appreciate our connection, our friendship, and then also the ability to work together to make a difference. So that's it.
Yeah, and I just want to give the audience a one specific example of, you know, I grew up loving home in America, like growing up, and I'm 45, we thought we were doing, my parents thought they were doing the right thing by not talking about race, and that just reinforces the power structure and dominant culture, and denies people their lived experience and access to them. But one of the things that was, it probably seems really obvious to you, but it was a light bulb moment for me, is when you were sharing daily for a couple weeks on end of all of these different perspectives of within kind of the tension between African Americans and Africans.
Right.
And for me, like, that is probably very obvious to you, but, and it's very visceral for you because you live in both of those
Absolutely.
Worlds, you know,
because
you were born in America. So right. you, by definition, are African American, but right. you spent 17 or probably 16 yeah. years living fully in the Congo and, mm-hmm. and go back all the time and all of that. And so you're caught in both worlds.
Yeah.
And so that was like, I don't know, you got really vulnerable in that moment. And I feel like that got us a lot closer. But I think a lot of white people like me are pretty oblivious to right. things like that.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it's a beautiful tragedy. I think when you look at the African experience in the Americas, right? This is these are same people, right? That were separated through historical cruelties, I would call it. And now it's there's a gap that we're trying to close. Because again, our bond is so real, is still there, and it's needed more so than ever. So when Africans and African Americans are not operating in sync, it bothers the heck out of me.
And what are some reasons why? Like, just, I know you could talk for
yeah, we can,
an
we
hour
can,
on
we
it,
can
but just
go
like
forever. But
give me like top three or top five.
It's part of the legacy of slavery was to cut off Africa and the roots and the cultural roots of slaves that came to United States or came to Brazil or came to Trinidad or came to other places, Cuba and so forth. What has happened is when you disconnect people from their roots and then you basically force them to go into a new culture, and then centuries go by, literally centuries go by, and now the perspective of those of us who grew up in Africa and the perspective of those of us who are here are completely skewed by the dominant culture. And so then when you reconnect, it's almost as if you're connecting with now new assumptions and stereotypes and lessons that you learned from dominant culture. So it's almost like getting reacquainted with an old friend after a decade has gone by. Like, you don't know what they've gone through. They don't know what you've gone through, but you know you come from the same place, right? And so that's really what we're doing, just focusing on reuniting more so than ever. I mean, even if you look at Ancestry.com and all of the movement of people going back and figuring out what their roots are, that's part of it. It's people reclaiming their origins. Ghana just had the year of the return, right? Where a lot of African Americans went back to Ghana and they went to places like Senegal, South Africa. It's beautiful to see the reconnect. And that's really what I want to focus on versus the all of the other stuff, the painful stuff. So,
and you have a vision of whether it's this year or next year, taking
absolutely
a group of like a dozen
yeah.
African American or Black
influencers,
leaders,
yeah.
influencers to several like South Africa, Congo, and Ghana.
Yes.
and then potentially go to a few places
here in the United States,
the U.S.,
and absolutely
have like these very intimate around the circle conversations.
Absolutely, it's roots and wings, right? I always talk about how Africa gave me my roots and America gave me my wings, and so what better way to connect with both side of the Atlantic than to go to somewhere like South Africa, where there's so much history from apartheid all the way till now, and then go to the Congo, where there's so much history and very personal to me growing up there, and then of course Ghana, as mentioned, and then
why Ghana?
Well, it was a significant post where slaves were taken out of, and it's a very haunting place, and so it's symbolic for healing, symbolic for reunification. It's symbolic for so many progressive things that we can do now that we're reconnected. And then here in the United States, you know, Jamestown, Virginia, right? This is where it all started in 1619, the first slaves who arrived here. Places like Alabama, Mississippi.
There's a museum,
the Lynching Museum, that's there. And then the African-American Museum that's in D.C., right? Go through and experience these things so both cultures can get to know each other once again, and this time for good. You understand me? This time is for good. So it's actually super, super exciting, and I think that would be just another opportunity to connect and get reunited. So I'm looking forward to it, and I want it to be an annual thing, but let's start with the first one.
That's awesome. Just going to switch gears real quick here. It's the beginning of the year. It's end of January, early Feb, when this will launch. And you and I have had a lot of conversations with other, you know, mutual friends we've had of this question that you keep posing out there that I think is really cool for everybody to hear and kind of reflect on as they look to the whole decade of 2020, but definitely for the year of 2020. And it's, what's your personal hashtag? So give me some insight of that and then share with us what yours is and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Every time we begin a year, there's an energy. There's a new energy. It's an opportunity to hit the reset button, right? It's an opportunity to hit refresh. It's an opportunity for introspection, looking back, right? What has happened? What worked? What didn't work? We get reflective. And then we kind of gather ourselves, get present before we start looking forward, right? What we want to accomplish this month, this quarter, this year. And so to have something that anchors you is incredibly important. And in the world of social media, in today's world of hyper connectivity, why not use hashtag, right? So if you were to be asked, what is, in one word, your hashtag for the year, or in one sentence, what is your hashtag for the year? Like, what will you be focused on? And that helps anchor someone and use it as a reference guide every time you deviate, or life happens, or you just have something that you can always go back to and have it be your North Star. So what is your hashtag for 2020 or for the decade that we're just embarking in? And for me, again, making it personal, I think the hardest thing we can do in life is to be someone else. And yet many of us, in fact, most of us try to do that all day. But the easiest thing we can do is to be ourselves. But for whatever reason, folks are trying to dance around that. So apparently being yourself is hard, unfortunately. It shouldn't be. And I found myself dancing between two. How do I authentically show up? how do I really live my values? How do I really live who I am in a world where I have to make money, in a world where I have to influence, in a world where I have to be a parent, in a world where I'm outside of my comfort zone plenty of time, in a world where my audiences change from minute to minute, hour to hour, day to day, right? So how do you stay anchored? And so that was my focus for 2020. And that is why I went back to Roots and Wings. It's just that simple. I live a duality life. And sometimes, you know, you go through an identity crisis where both sides are not complementing each other. They're actually working against one another at times. And so there's friction. And so how do you marry the two? How do you create this hybrid? And by roots, I mean Africa. That's who I am. Growing up in the Congo, the values that my parents, grandparents, friends, society taught me there, from Ubuntu to family values, to working in the collective harmony, all of these things. And then America, coming to America, awesome. I mean, we're talking opportunity, growth mindset, getting outside of your comfort zone, never settle, never be satisfied, that drive, that ambition. I absolutely love both. Now, making sure that both are in sync has been the challenge, right? Because sometimes, you know, you go back home and you're in a different space, and you come here, you're in a different space. And now my focus for 2020 and beyond is to really anchor myself around my roots and wings. So my challenge to your audience is to look in the mirror, do some introspection, okay, and figure out what will really anchor you, and I'm talking about roots, and what will stretch you, and I'm talking about wings, right? Because roots are who you are, wings are who you can become. Now, both are incredibly important. So that would be my little, you know, my guide, if you will, as people are thinking about how they're going to crush it in 2020 and beyond. So that's it.
Okay, so formally, it's hashtag Roots and Wings. Absolutely. Not just Roots and Wings, but hashtag Roots and Wings. Absolutely. And that's going to show up in like everything. Instagram posts and in your
refrigerator.
Yeah. In your practice, on diversity, inclusion, and leadership, and all those things. Absolutely. And then I'm going to give you a secondary and third hashtags of hashtag Sweet Lou. And then your third one is hashtag Ubuntu Forever.
Oh, my God. I love it. I love it.
I promise it. I was listening to everything you said, but I was thinking about that at the very end, and I had to share that.
I appreciate it. I'll take the Ubuntu. That's awesome.
You don't like Sweet Lou?
No, it is. That's cool. I'll take that too. But, you know, obviously that I'll let you say that. Yeah. But I'll go with Ubuntu and Roots and Wings.
All right. Well, I know you didn't ask because you don't care as much about me as I care about you.
Come on. It's your show. I'm just sitting here like, I'm not going to, you know, switch roles. I'm not asking questions, but by all means, Brian, what is your hashtag?
I'm so glad you asked, Lou. Oh, that's so nice. So my hashtag, because we've talked about this. So my hashtag came to me through meditation. So I've been very disciplined on meditation for the past like 5 weeks. I've meditated every day, except I haven't meditated this morning because I've been waking up at 5:45 to meditate, and I just needed to give myself permission to sleep into 6:15, and I feel really good about it. Anyway, my hashtag, and I think because I'm meditating, it's like pulling from my subconscious, and that these two words kind of came to me, and it's hashtag healthy danger.
Okay.
Because there was part of me that felt like I've done a lot of talks on embrace being uncomfortable. I've written articles on it, but then I was starting to take that at its merits, and I wasn't intentionally seeking to get uncomfortable, specifically as I engage with a community.
Right.
And so I think for the past 4 years, I've been really, really inspired by one of our really, really good mutual friends, mm-hmm. Ben Sand, and his whole notion of the nonprofit he runs, The Contingent, is literally like what, basically like seeing a burning building and running into it. So the newest initiative that he and his team have launched is called Know Me Now. We at Thesis as an agency have helped to come up with the name and the brand and the website and all of that. But our family has talked a lot about how do we engage with, folks, moms and dads in prisons coming back into the community and having kids who are often in foster care. And Know Me Now is really in this reunification. There's a secondary hashtag formulating between us two right here, the reunification bit. But really, I haven't had friendships with many folks who've spent a lot of time in prison. And I think there's a lot of richness there to gain and perspective. And, I think, my family and I, we've been talking a lot about that. And I think that hashtag, the reason why I have taken such a liking to it is because it's this intentional reminder of like your North Star. So like, I need to get back to that. I've been making decisions where I haven't had that top of mind, and I need to. That's what I like about the hashtag is that it pulls you back into this is my intention for the year.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh man, that's powerful. That's powerful.
There you go. All right. Thanks for being on the show with the recap, Lou, and a little mini episode before we hear the full 45-minute version of from 15 months ago.
So, I appreciate it, Ryan. Yeah. Much love. I appreciate it.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here, Ryan.
It's awesome. Great. Well, Lou, I also am super psyched for this interview. Every time we do these two-hour breakfasts, where I'm your guest in your house, I always walk away with these like profound insights on the secrets of life. So, so hopefully the audience and I will get some of that in this nice little 45-minute rap session.
Are you kidding me? I'm pumped. The feeling is beyond mutual. I think having watched you from afar, your work here at Eroy, but more importantly, your Eli work, it's just awesome. So you're a quality individual. And so the opportunity for me to come here and exchange a few nuggets with you is awesome. So I'm ready. Let's go.
It's going to be fun. Cool. All right. So I always start this with starting at the very beginning. And actually, you just reminded me before we started this that you're born in Boston. You're a Patriots fan. But then you move back to Congo and grew up until you're 17 in Lubumbashi, Congo, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So just give me a sense of what it was like when memories started to form at 3 or 4 years old, like kind of what was that like?
Right. My life is pretty much a zigzag story, right? My father came to United States in 1967. With the help of Presbyterian missionaries. So he left the Congo to the College of Worcester in the middle of Ohio, right? Liberal arts college. My mom, the smarter of the two, she got a scholarship in 68 that took her from Congo to Vassar College in New York. Now, these two didn't even know each other in the Congo. So mind you, here they find themselves in the US in the late 60s because my mom came with a group of Congolese people that included one of my dad's cousins. So my dad's cousins gets on a Greyhound bus, goes from New York to Worcester, brags about this foxy lady back in New York. And so my dad decides to go visit him, and that's how they met. So these two folks met here. 1970, my father finishes college at Worcester. They go back home. They get married. They have my two older sisters, Esther and Sengu. And then they come back to the U.S. for their advanced degrees. Now they're in Boston. My dad is at UMass. My mom is at Boston State College. My older brother's born, and then I'm born. So by birth, my brother and I are the two Americans in a family of Congolese. So I'm born in Boston, and less than a year after I'm born, we all move back to the Congo. So I grew up in the Congo. As an American, that's the funny part, right? So until I was 17 years old. And growing up in the Congo, man, it's amazing. It's the best and the worst put in together. I mean, as a kid, you know, you grow up playing outside. You never wanted the sun to go down because electricity wasn't always guaranteed. So it was always dark, you know, inside the house, candles or little lamps. So we always wanted to play. The minute the sun came up, we're out the door all the way till the sun come down. So I was just playing outside, and then and just dealing with all kinds of customs and respecting your elders, the importance of family, all of those anchoring type of values.
And your dad was this respected university professor and kind of like a leader in the community, right?
Absolutely. Still is. I mean, he's a psychologist. Unfortunate for me and my siblings.
He picks you apart.
Man, we couldn't get away with anything, man. This dude. And so it was great to watch him early on. In fact, that's where I got all my inspiration, my motivation to do what I do. Because at age 7, I messed up this finger here. I had a little accident, and they had to put stitches. Okay. And so then they took me to the University of Kisangani, where my father was teaching. And it was the first time I saw him in his element, mm-hmm. right? So if you can imagine the 7-year-old brain looking at my father on one side and about 800 students on the other side. It was like a stadium type of...
Huge.
Yeah. And I don't know what they're doing, right? But I'm like, oh my God, this guy is cool. There has to be some kind of transfer of value that's happening. And I couldn't quite understand what was going on. But it left such an impression on me. I was like, wow, I want to be like my dad, right? And but just to go on the other side, when it comes to my mom, unfortunately, she passed away when I was 4 years old. That's 1980. And so I never really got to know her or, you know, see for myself all these great things that I've heard about her. So she inspires me in a different way because, you know, I want to make her proud in case she's watching down on me, right? But my father has been the central figure when it comes to my life.
That's awesome. And so... So you've got two older sisters and a brother, and what, like, the age span, and were they, I know, like, athletics was a big part of your childhood and all of that. Were they into the same things?
Well, my two sisters, the oldest, they were not too much into sports, but my older brother and I, it's soccer. I mean, this is Congo, right? Soccer is religion. It's life. We see anything that's round and we want to kick it, whether it's an orange, whether it's a, you know, lime, whether it's an avocado. I mean, you name it. Anything that's round.
What about mango? I know mango's your thing. Ooh, you eat that.
Oh, my gosh. That's, I mean, mangoes, that's serious business. I absolutely love mangoes. In fact... See, Ryan, when you grow up with food insecurity, right, when you're hungry practically every day for 17 years, but for 4 months out of the year, okay, for 4 months out of the year, the heavens will open up, right, and it'll be mango season, and I would just grab my knife and disappear into the trees and just gorge, like, we're talking hibernation, a bear, right? And so I would be up there for hours. My brothers would be up there for hours. And so, yeah, between soccer, playing outside, and climbing mango trees, life was good, man. Life was good. Can't complain.
Cool. So when an adult would come up to you at, like, let's say 10 or 12 years old and say, Lou, what do you want to be when you grow up? Would you say, well, I want to be a professor like my dad, or like what, or I want to be whatever famous soccer player was in the Congo? Like, what was that answer?
Right. First of all, this is a great contrast between America and the Congo or Africa.
Right.
That question.
I was gonna preface it, but I was like, well, is that too assumptive to assume that the cultures were that different? I don't know.
It's crazy. Because, in fact, I noticed that, right? Because that's such an American question, right? Yeah. What do you want to be when you grow up? Because this is the land of dreams, right? So people get excited about possibilities and what someone's vision is, right? Back home, I'm sorry, it was just survival, man. Nobody, I mean, it was like, are you going to be here tomorrow, right? I mean, it wasn't something that was part of everyday conversation. So you just work to prepare yourself for success. In other words, it was all about getting good grades and going to school, and then whatever happens, happens, right? It was all about being a person of integrity and character. It was all about respecting your elders. It was all about working together because, you know, interdependence was something that was just ingrained in us from the beginning. I mean, that's survival, right? So those are the things that we worked on. And so being a good person and studying would give you the chance, right? Will just increase the odds of you having a good life. But a clear vision of what, you know, you want to be when you grow up, that wasn't a main question. But for me, though, Ryan, it was cool because watching my father connect with people and being this professor and adding value, I always wanted to be a teacher or an orator, someone that will work so hard on myself so that I can have value for others the way my father did, right? So that was clear,
yep,
in terms of the big umbrella why. But I didn't really know exactly how I was going to do that. That part was still fuzzy and unclear.
Okay. So I'm trying to figure out, like, the cultural – I'm fascinated. I love international travel. We've had these conversations where my 5-week trip to Tanzania and Kenya, yeah, when I was 15 changed my life. And I'm really curious of what, so 12-year-old school kids, did everyone go to school? I know, you know, you created a school, yeah, and because there was this dream that people would have a better education and things like that. But I just, like, what is the normative or the normal experience for kids? And, like, why would you create that school? And what is growing up as a 10, 12-year-old like in the Congo?
Well, education is a privilege, not a right. When you live in a country where the average income is less than $2 a day and you pay for everything from kindergarten to your PhD, right? So those who go to school are those who can afford to go to school. And so when you have parents in poverty making tough decisions like, do I feed my kids or do I send them to school? These are tough questions. So currently we have a country of about 71 million people, and yet we have 9 million kids that cannot go to school, right? So you can imagine how I was always aware of that, how lucky we were to be going to school, because, you know, we wear these uniforms, right? Like blue shorts, and the ladies will have blue skirts, and then we'll have like a white shirt. And so you can tell walking around who's a student and who's not. So right, to walk around and see just a sea of students with their uniforms, and then to also see an even bigger number of kids that do not have on uniforms during school hours, that was always a tough thing to see, because you couldn't ignore that reality, that this opportunity was not given to others. And so that's why it was a no-brainer when we were in a position to be of some help, building a school was automatic, because the way we say it back home, when you take the elevator to the top, always send it back down for someone else. And so that was our way to democratize opportunity for others.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right, so I'm going back and forth in time here. Going back to, I really want everyone to hear when you first fell in love with, or even discovered who Michael Jordan was. And, you know, for me, he was my hero. I had a poster on the wall of like the classic Jumpman, you know, pose and all that.
Yes.
And you have a picture in your senior yearbook.
Yes, in Ashland.
Yeah, in Ashland, Oregon, with that same just like, ah, just crushing it with a dunk. But yeah, tell us about when you first discovered this insanely beautiful athlete, Michael
right.
Jordan. Yeah.
Right. So we grew up, you know, with very modest means. And so it wasn't until 1992 that we got an actual color TV and a VCR. Okay, Ryan? That was like winning the lottery.
Game changer, right?
Game
there.
Changer. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So before that, all these years, we just had this little small black and white television that will be on when you're lucky. So anyway, that was a big step up, right? So I had a few of my friends who they've had, you know, a better life, and they've had, you know, access to things, and they would exchange VCR tapes at school. And of course, I couldn't be part of it until that moment when we actually had a VCR and a color TV. So I went in, and I was just begging them to give me any VHS tape. It didn't matter. I just the fact that I could watch a movie or something inside my house was the most amazing thing ever. And so they gave me two VHS tapes. First one was MTV Jams, right? Now you can imagine, I'm in the Congo, it's 92, and I put this tape in, and Bobby Brown comes up, Naughty by Nature comes up, Duran comes
Arrested
up.
Development.
Arrested Development. You have Aerosmith, you know, Jenny's Got a Gun, yeah. Right? All of that stuff, right? And so I'm consuming everything because I'm thinking, wow, this is America. It's really cool, pop culture, you name it. But the second tape, Ryan, the Game Changer tape, was 1991, Game 5, the Bulls against the Lakers in L.A. So Jordan and his team is wearing all red, and they're playing against Magic Johnson. And I was just captivated, mesmerized to watch this guy, number 23, flying all over. And I told my dad, the hell with soccer. I'm done. I'm done with soccer. I want to play basketball. And so I begged him to, you know, just give me a basketball. He gave me a cheaper version of a real basketball, but it was good enough. And I just became obsessed with basketball. And my grades went down a little bit. And so then he had to, you know, confiscate that to, you know, incentivize me to actually do the work. But since then, it's just been basketball.
So that was 92, and then 94 you moved to
93.
Oh, yeah. 93 you next moved year to like this, like Oregon and Ashland, Oregon, of all places.
Of all places, my man, a black dude in Ashland, Oregon. I was like, what is going on? Culture shock, man. But seriously though, Ashland was a beautiful place my junior and senior year. And the reason we went to Ashland is because my American grandparents, if you will, these were my dad's host parents in 67 in Worcester, Ohio. They had long since retired, and they were living in Ashland, and they were the people we knew. So Ashland was our destination when
we
came.
The Presbyterian minister?
Yes, yes, yes.
So, yeah, I got it. Okay.
So it was great. We went to Ashland, and then so it was literally a year into basketball. Now I'm going into a high school and they speak English, and I've never seen anything like it, all the things and access that high school students have, and I'm playing organized sport. And so it was just hitting the ground running and trying to do well in school, trying to adapt to the culture and also play ball. And so I had a great time my junior and senior year.
And so your primary languages, are they Swahili and French and English, or like what?
French, okay. Swahili, Lingala, Chiluba, and Kikongo. These are the languages that I grew up speaking in the Congo. But of course, in Ashland, it's all about Shakespeare. So I had to learn English when I came here. So it was fun. I mean, the thing about it, Ryan, you know this, it's about immersion. Once you're in a culture and you don't have a choice,
right, yeah.
and all of those other languages are useless, right. Then you just kind of, your brain goes into this other mode, man, yeah. where you just become obsessed because you don't want something like language to be a barrier between you and success.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's awesome. So that's actually a great segue. As you know, my daughter's 13 and 16, and I'm starting to do a lot of touring of colleges and things yeah. like that with her, and really getting her to think through SAT versus, you know, all of the, there's a lot of pressure, and mm-hmm. that's a very American thing, but I would imagine with a dad as a university professor, you started thinking about college, you know, right when you got to Ashland, Oregon. And what was that process like, and how did you, because you ultimately graduated from Portland State University, right?
Absolutely.
How did you make that decision and decide what to do?
Right. Again, education being so important, and my dad being in that field all of his life, I knew college was the expectation, no question there. But of course, adapting to the American system, learning English, and SAT exams, I didn't know what the heck that was, right? To take these tests and even the format of the test, it was just completely different. Anyway, after I graduated from high school, this is 95, I went to the College of Worcester to follow my parents' footsteps. So now here I am where my dad was in the late 60s and even where my mom visited, right? So it was very special for me to be there. It's a great liberal arts college. But, you know, I was for the first time just on my own, and it felt a little lonely. Worcester, Ohio, it's a small Amish town. I mean, not much was going on there.
And so, 6'4" right. black man from Congo in America, like in an Amish town.
Right, right. Yeah. But, you know, great, great liberal arts college. So I wasn't really thriving, if you want to put it that way. But my sisters, both graduated from Southern Oregon University in Ashland. They had moved to Portland. So I came to visit them one summer in 98. I was like, I'm not going back to Ohio. I'm sorry. I love Portland. So I fell in love with Portland and decided to transfer at Portland State University, and loved it. Finished in international studies, wanted to understand global issues. Africa was my regional focus. So we looked at everything from trade, economic development, leadership, conflict resolution, you name it. Because I wanted to see how do you influence people at a large scale. And that was the only major that kind of gave me a glimpse of that, because my life has been very international. And so that was a no-brainer. And that's why I did it, which is great.
So if I look at your high school and college experience, there was a lot of independence that you had and like major shifts that you had to adapt to.
Yeah.
To ultimately, I mean, kind of give you the confidence that you could do anything. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, what if you had to pick one life event in that, or maybe even going back to if you were 4 years old and mm-hmm. your mother dying, like that, like what do you think that life event was that like was either so brutally hard that you overcame that, or just or so confidence building that it created a platform to for you to have that internal conversation of like, oh, it makes sense that I'm CEO of this amazing company, you know, impacting a bunch of lives because of what happened, you know, earlier in life.
Absolutely. It's a combination of things. I always say this: Africa gave me my roots and America gave me my wings. And that's just the anchoring of who I am, right? So my father, my grandparents back home, my culture in the Congo really instilled so much confidence and also joy of living, because life is so fragile where I'm from. And so you really appreciate every day. You're very grateful. You wake up every morning like, uh-oh, I got one more chance at this, right? So it's exciting. It's absolutely exciting. That gives you a joie de vivre. In other words, you're just full of life, right? So that was a gift. then coming to America, are you kidding me? This is the land of opportunities, right? You don't come here for a job. You come here for a dream. So I already knew that because my parents went to school here. So that was always in the back of my mind as to how do I stretch? How do I become more than I've been? Now, my mom passing early had a huge impact, right? I mean, she was 29 years young. And so that's a number one reminder that tomorrow is not guaranteed, right? Make the best of every opportunity you have, right? When life is so fragile, there's a quote I heard later in life that said, the tragedy of life is not that that it ends so soon, but instead it's that we wait too long to start living, right? So that's a huge plus early in my life to understand the importance of getting going, if you will. That was one. And then in high school, this is 1992, Ryan. This was my biggest failure. After years of trying, I finally got into this school, which was a really prestigious, difficult to get in, very expensive school. It was like our little mini Harvard in the Congo, if you want to call it that.
That was in Lubumbashi?
In Lubumbashi, Congo. Okay. I finally got in after tests and tests because, you know, it was just tough. And if you fail even one class, you start the whole year over, right? So it was very rigorous. And so last day of school, when you walk in to go find out whether or not you passed, and everything in blue means you did well. And if you see anything red on your report card, that means you failed a class. It's pretty much the end of the world. And so I get my report card, and at first glance, it looks like the ocean, right? So it's all blue, and I'm just about to celebrate. And I do like a second take, and trigonometry, I failed that class, which meant everything that I did was for none. And I got to tell you, Ryan, knowing how my father, how little money he made and how expensive that school was, I felt like I let him down. I felt like I let my whole family down. And I must have cried for a couple hours straight walking back about an hour and a half from the place of school all the way to our house. And it was just literally the worst day of my life until that point. Now I'm waiting for my dad. My dad is going to come home around 7. And so I'm dreading him coming through the doors and giving him the bad news. And sure enough, he shows up. And, you know, I walk up to him. My head is down. I'm still in tears. And I say, you know, hey, dad, we didn't do it. Interesting. I said we. You know, that's a survival.
Well, you're using communication tools, right? Of we,
right,
versus I. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, and I'm just, you know, ready to receive any kind of punishment that will come from it. And, you know, he's a psychologist. He completely threw me a curveball, which I did not expect. And he says, what are we going to do about it? And I was not expecting that question. And I sat there and I said, I'll be ready next time. And I got to tell you, Ryan, from that moment, which was the lowest of lowest, I literally became obsessed. Now, I don't know if pain and hurt are really the key to success in life, but it's pretty close because I did not want to feel that way ever again. And I just went completely opposite. I was so obsessed with success. I read everything. I studied. I walked around. I mean, you know, I had mentors. I just went gangbusters and set all sorts of school records that are still standing today in Lubumbashi, Congo. But that came from pain. But after I did that, I thought, whoa, if I can do this, what else is possible, right? So my level of confidence went through the roof. In fact, that has been one of my challenges because, you know, it's not something you can just duplicate on command if you don't have the pain and the hurt that comes with it, right? Yeah. But that really gave me confidence. And then when we finally got a chance to come to America, I was like, okay, this is it. this is it. This is the wing factory, right? Wings, right, are made here. Dreams are made here. So that also gave me an impetus for even more action. So the zigzag between the two continents and being in a place like this where you come for your dreams, not for your jobs, this has been it.
That's awesome. And I remember you telling me what you read was like a fascination with how leaders live their lives and the qualities of everything from Abe Lincoln to Gandhi to
Nelson Mandela, Desmond Tutu, you name it.
All of that. So that's a segue to kind of the origin story of Be More, Give More. You graduate from PSU, you maybe do a couple jobs. You're at African American Health Coalition. And then you're like, I'm going to do my own thing. Like, tell us about that.
Yeah. I've known my why since I was about 11 or 12, but I never had the courage to actually go all in, right? And so in that regard, I was afraid. My why was always about adding value in the lives of others. So when I finally decided to jump, which is November 23rd, 2006, that was the day, November 23rd, 2006, where I walked into my boss's office and said, I'm done. It's time for me to finally do this. I've waited long enough. And mind you, at the time, I'm just getting married. We're just starting a family. So it's terrible timing, absolutely terrible timing. But I knew it was time to live life at the intersection of success and significance. This is really where Be More, Give More came from, right? The idea of success is you and me taking the elevator to the top, right? It's about us accomplishing and closing the gap between where we are and where we could be. That's all about potential. So whether it's a company, whether it's an individual, everyone has a gap to close, right? There's always that frustrating gap between where you are and where you want to be. And so that's an endless pursuit. And that's where success comes from. But as you know, you cannot find meaning and purpose just on that alone. Meaning and purpose comes when you help others. Meaning and purpose comes when you can use your success to influence and build a school or start a internship program, or, you know, that's where real meaning and significance comes. So both are incredibly important together. I learned very early on that success without significance feels empty, right? You meet people who've made millions of dollars, have mansions, but they feel empty because it's always been about them. Now, on the other hand, significance without success is not sustainable. I mean, you can love the world all you want. If you don't have resources to back it up, you're not really going to move the needle. So both are incredibly important. So I wanted to create a hybrid model that combines success and significance, because success gives us that sense of accomplishments, pride, we can do anything, and significance gives us the chance of meaning and purpose. So I decided to just start my own business and my own nonprofit. So the school and EduCongo, that's all about significance. It's about helping others, sending the elevator back down. The business, which is also very people-focused anyway, it's leadership training, consulting, coaching, and that's the Be More, Give More combination. And I feel like that gives me both, and that intersection is really what it's all about.
And specifically, you are starting to help more like full management teams of companies to kind of be their better selves. Like, how do you describe what you do?
Absolutely. Humanity's greatest challenge, or I would even say greatest tragedy, right, is unrealized potential. Unrealized potential. You can be in China, Guatemala, Congo, Portland, Oregon. It doesn't matter. Unrealized potential is the number one issue on an individual level, as well as the company level, team level, you name it. And the best tool we have to solve that problem is leadership. The best tool we have is leadership. self-leadership, leading others, leading change, leading through crisis, developing other leaders, and leading together. These are the tools that we actually can use to start closing that gap. So, of course, what do you see? You see CEOs, VPs, managers, supervisors, all trying to figure out how to get their employees engaged, how to increase the bottom line, how to develop a great culture, how to wow customers, you name it. There's all these challenges. And then we also have those tools to help with those challenges. So I started working with companies at a consulting level, working with CEO and executives at a one-on-one coaching level, and then changing employee culture, increased engagement, develop leaders who can actually look at it from two ways. Not only keeping the business thriving, this is about higher performance and things of that nature. Second, to really be the kind of leaders that people want to follow, right? You cannot teach what you don't know, and you cannot lead where you won't go. So the idea is, how do you internalize these principles so they're not just tactical, they're part of who you are?
So
that's what I get to do, Ryan.
Yeah,
that's
what amazing. I get to do. So there's, and there, I think a lot of CEOs, when they think about having a coach, they think, oh, does a coach have my expertise in my industry?
Yeah.
Or is this a coach that's going to help me from like a HR culture perspective? Mm-hmm. Or is this a coach who's like run a 80 person, you know, company like mine? Mm-hmm. And so like, how do you, because this podcast is called Faces of Marketing, how do yeah. you differentiate from other coaches
right.
out there? And then my next question is going to be like, you are so gifted with relationships. Do you find yourself more selling, or do you have a strategy for kind of the content that you create in and content marketing? Is that your, so yeah, those two things, differentiation and then, and some of your best tools for marketing.
Right. Being people-centered is everything to me. In fact, when God was giving out skills to people, I showed up on people day, and that's the only thing I know how to be is human. That's literally the only thing. That's my strength zone, right? And I know this from not only experience, but also studies. As a CEO or as a leader, your company's growth will not exceed your own. So the number one job is, if a leader really wants their company to grow, they have to grow. So, because their company will not go past their level of growth.
I just had this conversation with my small group of entrepreneurs that we mm-hmm. went to Central Oregon. And the way that I had this, basically the same epiphany that you're talking about, but being a tiny bit more specific, is the level of self-awareness
yes.
that a CEO, the capacity for that self-awareness to grow, is the limiting factor to how much the company can, like, the company's going to cap out at yes. where the CEO's capacity caps out.
Absolutely. And they have a lid, whether it's self-imposed or externally, there is a lid. And my job, literally, Ryan, my job is to be a lid remover, right? That's my job. Because the minute, whether that happens one-on-one or sometimes it's with an executive team, is to remove that lid, because they have to understand the parallel between their growth and their company growth. That's where the one-on-one coaching, the executive coaching comes in handy. Second piece of that is just having a thinking partner, having an accountability partner, having someone that will evaluate your growth quarter to quarter. It's a huge benefit. I have my own coach. I have my own mentors who are helping me do that, right?
How do you measure personal growth? How's that possible?
Right, right. The thing is, it's very bottom up, right? So when you first connect with someone, it's all about assessing their strength, their weaknesses, and then contrasting that to their goals, right? Whether or not these goals are realistic based on their bandwidth and capacity, or this is just something that's aspirational. Once we establish both what you have in your toolbox, and then we put it next to your actual company goals, individual goals, we can see how realistic that gap is. And then we're going to reverse engineer to what we're going to do quarter to quarter, because I believe life, business is won 90 days at a time, right? A year is really 4 years in one. If you can manage 90 days, if you can manage 3 months and be successful and evaluate in that, you have a better chance to not only duplicate and grow from there, right? And so for me is you meet a lot of CEOs with a lot of different goals. Well, I want to make sure my my employees are happy. I want to make sure that we increase by 20%. I want to make sure that we hire more people. I will basically look through all of their goals and see the one thing. I don't know if you read that book, The One Thing by Gary Keller, the guy who started Keller Williams. It's a fantastic book that says, here's the thesis of it. What is the one thing that if you did well would make everything else easier or irrelevant, right? And so CEOs or team leaders, they have to understand, yes, they have a lot on their plate, but there's only a few critical activities that really move the needle. And until we identify that, they can get busy all day and not be productive. So I try to help CEOs, leaders, managers to understand what really matters. What are the critical few things that they can do every day? It could be one-on-one with their team. It could be making sure that they're always in touch with the client. It could be evaluating their process day to day, right? Those are the things that really move the needle. In my own business, for instance, lead generation is my number one thing. That's my number one thing. And I know
how do you do that?
Well, lead generation is everything, because when you're building your pipeline, when you're getting customers, when you're looking at your past clients, those are warm leads, right? You want to make sure your pipeline is always full. So what I do is this. I get three islands of focus in one day. What is an island of focus? An island of focus is basically 90 minutes uninterrupted. And then you take a break, because according to brain studies, we can operate at an optimal level for about 90 minutes before we need a break. And so if you can get two of those before lunch, that's amazing, right? So you do 90 days. So your phone is off, your email is off. It doesn't even matter anybody else's agenda. You're focusing on your lead generation, in my instance, right? Which is calling prospects, saying thank you, sending out emails, you name it, right? There's a whole list, and using software to make it easy and systematize it. Then you take a quick break. You do it again, and then it's lunchtime. Those two 90-minute islands of focus make you super productive. And then after that, after lunch, sure, you can check your emails, respond to a few crises here and there. You might even call someone just for fun. And then you do one more island of focus in the afternoon. Mind you, Ryan, that's only 4.5 hours. 4.5 hours in one day, when focused, is way more than what you see most people do, which is just do a whole bunch of tasks all day and they don't really move the needle, right? So I like focus, which has been incredibly helpful in my business once I identified that lead generation was my number one thing. And so I like to help leaders, teams to focus on those critical few activities versus all of the things that take up their time. For instance, when you open your email in the morning, that has nothing to do with your agenda. I don't know why people do that. They open their emails and now it's everybody else's agenda on your inbox, and you have to respond to it. You have to react to it. The hell with it. Start with your agenda, then get back to people.
And we talked about this at breakfast a few weeks ago, but Miracle Morning, have you heard of that?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Like this whole notion of, he carves out an hour, but mm-hmm. like for me, it's more like 20 minutes in the morning of the way that I do it is yoga and then basically meditate, you know, just really get clear with yep. meditation. And that, I don't know, something like studies have shown that 90%+ of leaders practice this, like practice components of this. So meditation being one, little exercise, visualization, journaling, those sort of things. But that, to your point, like we practice distraction in American culture.
Yes.
And that doesn't help with personal growth.
Absolutely.
Basically. Yeah.
And there's also the power of routine. We all have to have a routine. You know, it's like, don't start the day until you have it finished, right? And the idea is, why even wake up if you don't really know what you're going to do on your routine level? In other words, the night before, you should already have a clear plan of what's going to happen the next morning so that when you wake up, it's not, oh, what do I have to do today? You wake up following your routine, as you mentioned, meditating, exercising, having a good meal within the first hour to, you know, jumpstart your metabolism. I mean, you name it. Read something positive, not the news. Read something positive that will engage you. And then that start alone can make a world of a difference, you know, because you still have to deal with what? Traffic and coming into the office and dealing with people that may not have had their coffee, right? And so all of that, you got to be prepared for.
Yeah.
So as a leader, if you don't have your routine that sets you up for success, then the world will take over. Because, I mean, you know this, we live by default or we live by design, right? If you're not intentional about the design part, then the default takes over. You know, that's just life. And 9 out of 10 times, you won't like the default side. You probably want the design side.
That's right. All right. I got two last questions left. And this one's easy for everybody else, but for you, it's going to be hard because you're inspired by so many people, but if you had to pick right now in this moment, like who is inspiring you, who would you say that is?
Personally, it'd be my father. My father is 76 years old. I get to see him this Christmas. I'm going to go back home. And because he's always been that compass, my vision. He's the guy that has my back no matter what. He's inspired me to do everything that I'm doing. And then, you know, we're so lucky that he's healthy and that you want to spend as much time as you possibly can with him and gain his wisdom and love and perspective in life. So I can never get enough of that. So he's my constant inspiration. The second are my two boys. My wife and I were super lucky. My wife is a first grade teacher, Stacy, and we have two boys, a 10-year-old, Yenga, and a 5-year-old who's crazy, who needs Jesus. But anyway, we love him. And those two, they inspire me to be a better person and leave something for them. And so be an example the same way my father was to me or is to me. Now, my biggest highlight, I mean, people ask me about accomplishments and school and businesses and all that. It doesn't even compare. When my son was in third grade, okay, he's in fifth grade now, so 2 years ago, I was invited to speak at his class, right? When they have like career day. Oh my God.
I'm sure you overthought that like a mofo.
I was so nervous. Now I speak in front of thousands of people.
I know.
But that was hands down the most important 15 minutes.
I'm sure you prepared for like a month.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
Absolutely. And to have my son say that he was proud of me. That's it, man. That's why we do what we do. So I would definitely put my father and our two boys almost like in a bookend kind of a way. You know, my two boys are following us and I'm following my father. So I'm kind of in the middle of these two forces, right? One, it's about legacy, and the other one is about the future. So it's pretty cool.
That was such a beautiful answer. I think we just, and my last question is more of a, kind of the surprise factor of like, what would we not know about you that would just kind of, it kind of gets back to the question of those meaningful life moments. But is there anything that you haven't shared with us so far that is just like, that kind of came up as through this conversation or before that the audience might not know about kind of your motivations, your why, like what's made you or what's coming up for you?
Yeah. Pain. My, 2 years ago, I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, with a few of my friends, and it was a life bucket type of thing. And I got to tell you, Ryan, you know, 19,000 feet, 341, it's miserable. Is absolutely miserable. And
hurts so good, or just right. Hurts and hurts and hurts. There's no good right. Part of it.
The most miserable 19 minutes of my life were at the top of Africa. The peak is called Uhuru, which is Swahili for freedom. Freedom means everything to me because it hasn't come so easy for my family, my ancestors, and colonialism and slavery and so on and so on. And so freedom has been a guiding post, something that even through my business and through my nonprofit work, it's always about helping people remove those lids, live the highest and truest selves, right? And so the reason I want that is because it's been lacking in my own personal life, right? My grandfather took his own life. My father worked so hard getting peanuts in terms of his compensation for years, all to give people value, right? And so in my own life, I've had a lot of pain that comes from that. That's my motivation too, right? To do that on my own so that I can actually have something to help others find freedom, find who they really are at the end of the day. And that's the first one, freedom. The second one that's incredibly difficult has been kind of an identity crisis, Ryan. As great as it is to have a well-rounded life, to travel everywhere, and you also feel like you don't belong sometimes, right? And so, you know, you go back home, you're kind of like that American guy, even though in the Congo, that's really your home. And then I'm here in the U.S., I'm also not fully an American, right? And so sometimes you feel like you don't belong. And that also creates a sense of anxiety and pain, right? And so I flipped it. And I used Ubuntu, the Zulu word from South Africa that speaks to the essence of being human. That's really why I like that common humanity. I like that unbreakable umbilical cord that ties all of us as human beings, because in that regard, we're all family, right? In that regard, it doesn't matter if you're white, black, Asian, Latino, if you're a man or woman, so-called able, so-called disabled, short, tall, it doesn't matter, right? You are human. That's the only thing that matters. So I've embraced that even more, but that also comes from the pain of feeling a little bit like an outsider in different places, right? So I was like, okay, all right, what unites us? Let me focus on what unites us. And this is where Ubuntu and our common humanity really helped me. So I would say between the quest for freedom and our common humanity, those would be kind of like the two mostly unknown things about me.
Well, you are gifted with being one of the most inclusive people I've ever met.
Thank you.
And warm and inviting. And
appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. Just the more we get to know each other, the closer our friendship gets. And so you delivered on the promise of some of the secrets of life, Lou.
I appreciate it. Thank you, man. The opportunity to hang out with you. And I mean, like I said in the beginning, We're kindred spirit. You're just a brother from another mother. So it's all love. It's all love.
Thanks,
it's
man.
All love, Ryan.
All right. Appreciate it.
All right. Later. Peace.